What we decided to speak about, what the plan was to speak about, issues in medicine that are critical life and death issues involving decisions, moral, ethical decisions, how the halacha looks at these things when there are those particularly agonizing issues that face doctors and patients. You'll see that a lot of the principles govern a lot of issues outside of medicine too, and you'll see that a lot of the issues, a lot of the principles, govern areas that aren't critical life and death issues either, and they are therefore principles that one has to know in general. Also, you'll see that even the most agonizing of these issues are really not only one-time critical emergency sort of issues. They actually often apply on a daily basis in medicine and in many other fields. So what I'd like to do is, we discussed this with a group of doctors in Johannesburg this week on a much more technical basis. Let's see if I can try and cover it on a base in a fashion that those without a medical background will be understand the issues without boring those who have more of a technical background. Please stop me if something's not clear on the immediate subject, okay? Not on another subject, because I hope to cover a number of issues. And please note down if something hasn't been covered at the end, then I'll leave time, and then you could ask on things that I didn't cover. There are so many applications of these principles, including transplantation, including experimentation in medicine, medical and surgical. There are so many issues to be covered, we can't possibly cover everything. I'll try and cover some of the broad principles. So please note down specific situations that you'd like to know about that I might be able to answer, or areas in general that I didn't cover. If the area you ask about is too big, we'll try and make a separate talk about that thing in general. Let's tonight try and cover some of the basic issues. What I'd like to do is this. First, I'll try and share with you some basic principles that govern some of the general areas that come into these life and death questions, and then from a life and death point of view, we're not discussing here tonight the other religious issues that come into medicine, for example, when you have to break Shabbos in order to save a life, right? That's not directly our subject tonight. That's of more of interest to doctors who are already observant and need to know how to balance their responsibilities, and we can do that some other time for a specific group of people. Or when you're all fully observant, as everybody should be, then we can talk about that. Like next week. Now, and then, with your permission, if there's time, I'll try and share with you a case, discuss with you a medical case, which is a very rare and agonizing case that probably happens once in a lifetime, which you probably will never see, but nevertheless brings out the principles that I'll try and share with you in a very dramatic way, and in a way that is applicable to many other cases that do occur often. So first of all, let's understand like this. Let's maybe build our discussion, although I'll try and enlarge on it and not stick directly to this. Let's try and build our discussion on the question of who gets the medical treatment, surgical treatment, the life-saving treatment, when there isn't enough for everybody who needs it. Okay, let's take that theme, the apportioning of scarce resources in medicine. How's that done according to the halacha? Are you with me? What happens when you have one respirator and two patients who need that respirator, or one amount of a drug and more than one person who needs it? What's the Jewish approach to that? Who gets it? Let's try and start off with that. You'll see that there's many, many issues that this covers. Dialysis when there aren't enough machines, transplantation when there aren't enough facilities. You'll see that it covers a decision on the part of a first aider who stops at an accident and has to help people and can't help everybody. Who do you help first? Agonizing issue. Does someone in your own family come before someone who's not related to you? What happens if you stop at an accident if, chas v'shalom, you come across somebody you know is related to you, but the first person you come across is not, and your own relative is? Do you overstep the first critically injured person to get to? Don't ask me. Okay, ask me only things I know how to answer. These are some of the issues that... Now, if you think about this question, you'll see that it's not just... Let's first of all put it in perspective. This is not just an issue in acute emergency medicine. This is an issue that cuts across everything. For example, if you look in the legal journals, you'll see that... I'm not sure if it's still active, but there was a time, 10 years ago, let's say, when a very vexed and taxing issue in the legal journals was the issue of what they call lifeboat ethics, which is the question that's been tried in the secular courts many times, and I'll try and mention one or two examples of what happens when, in order to save a life, one cannot save another life, or sometimes even worse than that, when you have to even sacrifice a life. Lifeboat ethics deal with the situation of you have people in a lifeboat where there's not enough food. Yes, for everybody. So who gets the food? What happens when the lifeboat's sinking and you have to throw somebody out so that the other people can survive? And there have been many cases that have been tried in the secular courts, and people in these situations have got back to society, and then cases have been heard because people's conscience began to bother them, and the secular courts have heard cases dealing with people killed each other, where they ate each other, right, in order to survive. What's the halacha that relates to those situations? How do you choose who it is that you eat or dispose of in these situations? Now, so you see that these are issues not just for the medical practitioner. If you look at it on a broader basis, you'll see that it's not only the doctor practicing in the acute situation. For example, you two. What happens if you are, for example, you're the administrator of a hospital? Now you have to apportion funds as to how you're going to run your medical service. And you have to choose whether you'll start a new well baby clinic, you know, where they give vitamins and weigh the children, when you don't have enough intensive care neonatal beds, maybe in your neonatal intensive care nursery. Are you allowed to start a low-key type medical facility using the funds from an emergency type thing? What's the halacha that relates to that? What happens if you see you might not even be medically qualified at all and have to make that decision? What happens at a governmental level? Some halachic thinkers have asked the question, what happens in a country where there's not enough money for critical care facilities? Right? For example, in Israel, in England, for example, many countries, in America today it's a problem. It didn't used to be until a few years ago, but today, even in the United States, it's a problem when there's not enough money for critical medical facilities. How do you apportion the facility? For example, is a country obliged to spend money only on the military and on emergency, you know, fix the roads only when they get dangerous and not on anything else? Or is the country allowed to spend money on beautifying the museums and the parks and the game reserves, which are not life-saving? That's the question. Because in halakha, we say that saving life takes precedence of everything else. We don't apply the law of averages or probabilities. We do anything to save a life. In the most extreme situations, we don't even one in many millions. So how can you... But it's not so simple. For example, there's a Gemara that says... Gemara says, if there are two towns on a hill, and a river runs past both of those towns, and there's enough water in the river that if the people upstream drink the water, then there'll be enough water carrying on downstream that the people downstream can drink. But if the people upstream will drink and wash, no water will be left and the people downstream will die. So what should the people upstream do? Should they drink and leave enough water for their brothers and sisters downstream, or should they drink and wash and leave none for them? What would you say? Drink only. So the Gemara concludes that they drink and wash. And the Gemara says, because if they don't, what will happen is there'll be an outbreak in that town of a disastrous illness. We don't exactly know what the word means anymore, maybe typhus or some other illness that will cost lives in the upstream town, not in the immediate term, but in the medium or slightly longer range term. Well, that's very interesting. That means you don't only have to take it. It might be that in a country, for example, if the country spends money only on the military and emergency things, and they don't do the museums and everything else, so maybe tourism will drop. Maybe then the economy will suffer in such a way that people will starve in a slightly longer than immediate. Maybe that's not simple. Not simple, these things. These are some of the issues, some of the background issues that have to be considered when you look at these things in medicine. Now, what are the criteria that we use in making these sort of decisions? So let's understand this. First of all, the criteria that are used in halakha often got nothing to do with the secular criteria. For those of you who are medically trained, you'll probably know that if you read the journals that deal with these situations, you'll see that they usually draw up lists of criteria as to who will be saved before whom, depending on criteria such as age, for example. That means a younger patient will be saved before an older patient, or somebody who has only one illness will be saved before somebody who has two or more illnesses. For example, if you look at dialysis programs today, and it's no different in Johannesburg, it functions this way, and there are many parts of the world, including Israel, England, and even now in America. I know a physician in New York who has to beg other hospitals to take his dialysis cases because he doesn't have enough dialysis time on his machines. Now, how do they select patients for dialysis? So, for example, age. In England, at least the last published figures that I saw, it may be different now, in England, if a person is over 62, they got sent home to die. Okay, you get sent home to die if you need dialysis in England, if you're over 62, not because they're prejudiced against people older than 62, but the facilities are limited, and statistically they can cope with certain, if you cut it off at age 62, they can cope, using other criteria too. In halakha, that's got absolutely no validity. Age has got nothing to do with saving a life in halakha, except with one exception, as I mentioned here, I think before, in the question of abortion. That's an unborn child, in a Jewish case of a Jewish mother and a child, there the mother's life takes precedence over the child, until the child is halfway born, when the head is delivered, or if it's a breech, until the umbilicus is delivered, then the two have equal claim to life. And that's not because a fetus is not a human life. We understand that a fetus has a neshama from the moment of conception, maybe even before, but not That's the only exception. And for a non-Jew, it's much more serious, as I mentioned then, because abortion for non-Jews is a more serious problem. The fetus has a more enhanced status than it does in a Jew. It's a very interesting thing, which we're not going to go into now. Abortion is more serious for non-Jews. Now, so dialysis programs run now on the basis that, for example, I once heard from a physician involved in this field, who was happened to be a hematologist, who was involved once with a Johannesburg program in a certain hospital here in Johannesburg, where kidney dialysis was being given. And the man who ran that kidney unit happened to be a young Jewish doctor. And he was choosing patients for dialysis to save their lives, in other words, and rejecting others on the basis of secular criteria. For example, a young patient would get it before an old patient, and a patient with only one disease, namely his kidney disease, would get it before somebody who had, let's say, kidney and heart disease. After a while, his conscience began to bother him, and he wondered if this was the right way to do it. So he went to see a certain rabbi in town, and he asked him if this was the right way to do it, because he was using, and the rabbi said, pointed out to him, now I'm not issuing any rulings, I'm not capable of doing so, but just an interesting thing to understand. The rabbi pointed out to him that according to his criteria, an 18-year-old boy with kidney disease and no other illness would get dialyzed before a 45-year-old man with kidney disease and maybe coronary artery disease as well. But it could just happen that the 18-year-old is a single individual and the 45-year-old is a man who has five dependents who need him. Now, they don't take that into account. I'm not saying halachically that would be a criteria either. But whichever set of criteria you take, you're going to run into trouble because they're all mutually exclusive and contradictory. You follow? But the secular world doesn't relate to that. They just have a set of criteria. And if the person's, let's say, an alcoholic, or the person, let's say, is likely to abscond from therapy, he won't do all that's needed to keep himself going on dialysis. So then he's marked down the scale. Yeah, that might be logical. But they have a whole set of criteria. Most of these criteria are not recognized in halacha. The reason is that in halacha we consider life to be of infinite worth, and therefore you can't weigh one infinity against another. You follow? You can't weigh one infinity against another. Sometimes you may have to make a choice about which infinity you will save because of your obligation. For example, yes, you do have an obligation to relatives before those who are non-relatives. For example, when it comes to giving tzedakah, when it comes to giving 10% of what you earn, which is what you're supposed to do, at least 10%, not more than 20, then you are obliged to give it to people in your town before people in another town. If they're Jews who need money in your town, you're obliged to support them before people in another town. Yes? And there's a set of criteria where you're, not because he's worth more, but he's closer, more closely related to you. And he falls under your obligation more closely than somebody more distant. So yes, you might have. There is a case in the Gemara. There is a case of a Jewish community that has some of its members terrorized, taken, abscond, what do you call it? Abducted by terrorists, and then they want to ransom them back to the Jewish community. And the Gemara, unfortunately, this happened to Jews throughout the ages, happened in the Gemara times, in medieval times. The Gemara wants to know how much money you must pay to redeem these captives, because if you pay more than a certain amount, what will happen is they'll do it again. And many other interests. Well, one of the criteria is, which of them do you ransom back? Which of them do you ransom back if you can't afford to ransom them all? Imagine that agonizing. The Jewish community gets together and they have to decide whom they are going to save. They can't save all of them. Which of these captives are you going to ransom back? So there is a set of priorities. For example, women get ransomed back first, immediately, long before men. The Gemara says, because women are in danger, not only women are in danger of being disgraced in ways other than men would be, that sexually interfered with, and harmed in ways other than men would be, and their honor comes first. And people think Judaism is not feminist. And there are other criteria. If it's a relative of yours, for example, you may spend any amount. Whereas if it's not, then you're limited in how much you must spend. There are other criteria too. And there are criteria that possibly depend on what the community needs. It could be. Whereas in a medical decision, it could be that that doesn't apply. For example, there was a case in Hadassah Hospital. Just to share with you one or two agonizing issues. There was a case in Hadassah Hospital a number of years ago when penicillin was newly introduced. There were 6 or 8 cases of meningitis, and there was only enough penicillin for 2 of them. Meningitis, bacterial meningitis, a lethal illness, still is a very serious illness, and at that time it was almost certain that people wouldn't survive, and there was enough penicillin, and at that time this illness was exquisitely sensitive to penicillin, and you could easily cure those patients. Which 2 did you choose to give the medicine to? So the doctors in charge asked Rabbi Herzog, who was the chief rabbi of Israel at the time. I can't unfortunately say that doctors always ask rabbinic opinion, not in Israel or anywhere else, but on that occasion they did. So Rabbi Herzog was unwilling to issue a ruling by himself, and he phoned Rav Moshe Feinstein in New York, who was probably the greatest halakhic authority in the world. And I heard from somebody who listened to the conversation that Rav Moshe took 15 seconds to answer him. Immediately, he said, you walk in and give it to the first two. You don't make any choices. You can't choose one life over another. You walk in and the first two patients you give it to. So Rav Herzog asked him, what about the Gemara that says that there's priorities in ransoming back whom you ransom? He said, it's not relevant, and that was the decision. This kind of thing happens in medicine all the time. Maybe not the example of not having enough penicillin, but certainly not having enough transplant facilities or not enough dialysis machines. Sometimes you find that there are other criteria. For example, there was a case in Israel a few years ago of a machine. You might think this is humorous, not so funny. There was a case at Laniado Hospital. Laniado Hospital is a hospital in Netanya which is run on religious, completely Torah lines, run by the Klausenberger Rebbe and the Hasidim. They fund and run this hospital, the people who work there, religious people, and the hospital received the donation of a kidney dialysis machine, but with a wealthy American donor donated a kidney dialysis machine, but he donated it on a condition. The condition was that it was to be used only for tourists. Why? Why? Understand this. Because he thought the following thing, that if a patient is in kidney failure in America, let's say, they want to visit the Holy Land, they cannot visit Israel because time on a dialysis program is precious. You need to be dialed out 2 or 3 times a week for 8 or 12 hours, let's say. You can't, and the slots are fully occupied. The machines are used all the time. So you can't take off time on your program. You follow you. And no one in Israel is going to give you time on a dialysis program when they're fully loaded with their own patients. So it means a patient like this who desperately would love to go visit Israel. So what did he do? He donated the machine to Laniada. What's the idea? Patient will take himself off his dialysis program in America for a while. He'll go to Israel, and he'll plan his tour around Israel. So every 2 or 3 days, he'll pass through Netanya. He'll spend 8 to 12 hours on the machine, and he'll be able to see Israel that way. Beautiful idea. So what happened was the machine was installed, and shortly after that, of course, the inevitable happened. There was a patient who arrived who needed dialysis who was not a tourist. So they went to the Rebbe, and they asked him, Klausenberger Rebbe, they asked him what to do, and he said, Pikoch Nefesh, he used the machine. So now the machine's fully used all the time. Now don't ask me what would happen if a tourist came and somebody else who wasn't a tourist. Don't ask me who would have priority. I'm not capable of answering such a question. But that's the kind of thing. You should know, I hope it's clear, let me point it out explicitly if it's not clear, that whatever you hear this evening you cannot take as a definitive ruling. Okay? You have to, halakha works in such a way that it is very sensitive to the subtleties and particularities of a particular case, which means that whichever situation you're in, even if it sounds similar to what we discussed, you have to ask a specific question at the time and get a ruling on your specific case. Secondly, I'm not of a level halakhically that I can rule on these things anyway. I happen to be involved in this field just because of having a medical background. So often I'm involved as a go-between between the medical people who are not halakhically qualified and the great halakhic authorities because I have more background than maybe other rabbis in medicine. But I'm not qualified to give, certainly not these life and death issues that only the greatest are forced into dealing with. So we're just discussing general principles tonight. Is that clear? Not go home and make your own, do it yourself. Yeah. Now, sometimes these questions raise other issues. For example, in transplantation, there are other issues that are raised. For example, what happens when life-saving treatment has to be given, but it's at risk to another life? For example, the Torah has a mitzvah, Alei Samuel Al Dam Re'echa. You're not allowed to stand idly by the blood of your brother. That means if someone's dying and you can save them, you have to save them. You have to. The question is, at what risk to yourself? At what risk to yourself? So the classic situation is, for example, someone's drowning and you can swim. You're not free to stand there and not do anything. You have to jump in and save them. However, that's clear. However, what happens if you're not a good swimmer and they're a big, tough individual and the sea's rough, and the chances are that if you jump in to save them, two people will drown instead of one being saved. So if it's risky to that extent, then you're forbidden to try and save them, because it's called a chassid sheiter. Somebody who does such a thing is considered foolish because he's throwing away two lives instead of trying to save one. Of course, you should just know, you're not free to do nothing. The person can say that if you can't jump in and save the person, you have to run for help, and if you can't do that, you have to daven. You have to stand there and daven for the person who's drowning, because prayer can be effective in such situations, and you're obliged to do whatever you can. Anyway, but the point is that, now what happens, where's the cutoff, where's the borderline between what is risky and what's not risky? Now, look, it doesn't talk in terms of percentages. So, for example, let's say to save a life, you'd have to donate blood. So you definitely have to do that. There's no question about it. Because donating blood is so safe the risks attendant on donating blood. Even these days are so safe that you have to, unless you and your friend are sharing the needle, and then that might be a problem. But under normal circumstances, giving blood is so safe that you'd be obliged to do it. Giving bone marrow, probably you'd also be obliged to. There may be a question with the general anaesthetics involved. However, there are some things that are so risky that they change the category. The classic example is kidney transplantation. If you wish to be a kidney donor, let's say a person has someone in their family who's in renal failure, and they have to give a kidney to save that person. Are you obliged to give your kidney? This happens. It happens all the time. It happened to a Jewish family in Johannesburg recently. It happens all the time. Are you obliged to give your kidney, one of your kidneys, to save a sibling in your family to save their life? So now the Poskim have ruled very interestingly as follows. You see, giving a kidney is risky. Giving a kidney is no question, it's risky. The vast majority of kidney donors don't suffer in the long run at all from giving their kidney, the vast majority. But a significant number do. There's the risk of the anesthetic. Yes, it's a major operation to remove a kidney, and a general anesthetic carries a risk of 1 in 5 or 10,000 serious complications in the best hands. There's the risk of surgical problems, post-surgical infection. There's the risk that 20 years later you'll need your one remaining kidney will be injured, and you now desperately need that one kidney that you gave away. And it's very hard to quantify. You can't quantify what percentage risk there is in giving a kidney. You follow the problem. So what do you do? So here the Poskim have ruled unanimously that kidney donation is so risky that you don't have to give your kidney. But it's so safe that you may if you wish to. You hear that? It falls into that zone. It falls into that zone where it's left up to you. You follow? It's in that general area where the risks are great enough that we can't force you, but the risks are low enough that it's not foolish to do. Which means it's a fantastic mitzvah if a person does such a thing, but he can't be obliged. Now, if you consider it for a moment, you'll realize that raises new problems. For example, the problem that it raises is that the choice now, the onus now is on the donor. That's a terrible, terrible situation to be in. You have to stare into the dying eyes of a little brother and tell him that you're not going to give him your kidney. You follow? So to make such a decision is so agonizing that people in that situation can't make objective decisions. You follow me? Their emotions are too... So there have been suggestions. There's been a suggestion. There's a certain rabbinic authority in New York who suggested a particular solution to this problem, which I believe is being used in kidney transplant programs in the world in general now. And what they do is this. To solve this problem, at least alleviate the problem, is what they do. They call in the members of the family who might be compatible antigenically, you know what I mean, with the person who needs to get the kidney, and they call them in individually behind closed doors. When they get to the member of the family who is compatible, in other words, whose kidney they could use to save this terminal relative, they say to the person as follows, they say, look, in private, between you and us, we would like to tell you that your kidney matches. That means if you let us, we'll take your kidney and we'll save the life of your brother or sister. However, if you choose not to give us your kidney, we will publish falsely that you did not match. You follow? We will lie. We will publish, yes, we will falsify the test, and we will say that your kidney didn't match. The idea being that no one will ever know that you refuse to give your... You follow? If you want to give your kidney, we'll accept it. If you don't want to, in order to alleviate, you have a solution, in order to alleviate your emotions of having to say that you could but don't want to, we will publish that you couldn't have. Now, halakhically, you're allowed to tell lies in certain situations. You're certainly allowed to tell not all the truth. And in certain situations, you may even definitely falsify certain things. This doesn't make the decision easy. The person still has a terrible, terrible, agonizing decision to make. But at least it's not compounded, yes, by the non-objective. Now, you can think about it. It's a solution that's been proposed. That's one of the things. You see that there are many secondary issues that come up in these kind of situations. Let's talk about one... If we have time to discuss the case, I want to discuss with you. Yes, please.
What happens if the compatible kidney belongs to a child?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. The question... Yes, I understand. It doesn't have to be young. The question here is, what happens when the kidney that could save the life of this patient is possessed by a minor, by a child? A child, halakhically, cannot give consent that their kidney can be used. On the other hand, it's a life-saving procedure. So can we invade their body against their will? Can we give consent? Their consent is meaningless. Yes? Can we take their kidney to use to save somebody else's life? I've never seen a ruling on this halakhically. I'm almost certain, in my humble opinion, that there's no way you could do that, because you can't do something that's risky enough that the person himself could refuse against his wishes. But you need to ask such a question. However, I can tell you that this was heard in the American Supreme Court in the non-Jewish world a few years ago. It was a case of a 4-year-old boy dying of terminal renal failure. It was a non-Jewish family, and his 11-year-old sister was found to be compatible. So the surgical team wanted to take the kidney from the sister to save the life of the 4-year-old brother. So objections were raised on the basis of the fact that the girl's a minor, and according to secular law, she can't give consent. And you can't do surgery on somebody without consent, unless it's to save their life. But you can't endanger someone without their consent. The parent's consent here is meaningless. So the case was heard in the courts, and a ruling was issued that it was forbidden to take the girl's kidney. The case was heard on appeal, listen to this, Supreme Court appeal. An expert psychiatric testimony was brought by the surgical team to show the following thing. That when this girl, listen to this reasoning, when this girl grows up and becomes a major, 18 or 21, whatever it is, the psychological trauma she will suffer by knowing that her brother died and she could have saved him and didn't, will endanger her health more than the risk of giving a kidney. You hear that? And so they overturned the ruling and permitted surgery. Now, I don't know what happened. I didn't follow the case. I don't know what happened, whether they did or didn't do it. But that, now, I don't think that would hold any water in halacha at all, but that was such a case. Yes, please. What about them? Again, they can't give consent. Abnormal mentally. Again, so what we have called cherish, shete, the katan, that category of people, if he's called a shote, that means he doesn't have das, that, he cannot give consent again. You can't invade somebody's body just because they're abnormal. So the issue of consent again. Again, I'm not unlucky. I'm not qualified to tell you. You have to ask in that particular situation. But the general concept is that it's up to the agreement of the person. If they can't agree, you can't do it. But that needs to be more specifically worked out. Yeah. I read about that. I never understood the problem over there. Because it's only in a non-Jewish context, I imagine, that there could be a question of the morality. The question, I read the reports of it, and the question that was phrased in the secular press was the morality of conceiving a child only to be used to save someone else's life. In halacha, there's no problem. Having a child is a mitzvah. The fact that that child will now save somebody else's life is a compound of a mitzvah. I don't see what the problem is. It's not, because to them, in their world, you need a moral justification for conceiving a child. It's crazy. We think the other way around. We need big moral justification for not conceiving a child. We need big moral justification for contraception. But by them, you follow, to bring a child into the world, we need big moral justification. It's crazy. And taking marrow is such an unrisky procedure that I don't imagine there's any problem taking marrow even from a child. I mean, we can assume that the child certainly would consent, not like a risky thing like a kidney. Again, I'm no authority and I haven't seen this ruled on in any halakhic literature, so I easily could be corrected. But I don't see the problem. Getting marrow is not a risk. It's a little uncomfortable when they take a lot of marrow. The person feels badly bruised afterwards, but it's not a big danger. Except if there's an anesthetic involved, that might be more debatable. Any other questions on what we discussed so far? That's a good question. You probably are wanting to ask about heart transplantation. What we should maybe do is maybe discuss, what I'll do with your permission is try to discuss one or two more issues and leave the case that I was going to discuss with you to do justice to it to next week. Is that okay? Because it's a lot of details to be worked out, a lot of halakhic issues, fascinating case, and I think we should rather go through it properly and not just try and fit it into a few minutes. So let me cover some of the other basics in the background, and yes, please. Oh, is it next Sunday that he's doing this? That's what they told me to say. Well, all I can say is watch the press. I don't think they would schedule to things like that unless they tend to give me the night off. They haven't done that for I don't know how long. So. I can't see them doing that, quite honestly. I don't know. I really don't know. Can I just suggest that you call the office during the week, because I got the message third hand about next Sunday night, so could be wrong. When's the night is preparing? Sunday is that. Okay, I do not know. Okay, fine. But whenever we meet again to discuss this halakhic issues, maybe we could do it after Pesach. Lina, I will discuss a fascinating case just to whet your appetite. I'll just tell you what it was, okay? Just to whet your appetite, it was a case of Siamese twins who shared a heart. The problem being that the heart was not in two little girls born to a very religious Jewish family, where the heart was not strong enough to support the circulation of two children, and they both began to die. The question was, there's no way to separate that abnormal heart that they shared. The question was, were you allowed to separate the children, sacrificing the life of one to possibly save the one that you would leave with his heart, as opposed to doing nothing and watching them both die? The halachic problem being not just that you are choosing one life over another, but that you're actively taking a life to save a life. Okay? That is the halachic problem. And to take a life to save a life is a massive discussion in halacha. I'll try and show you some of the fascinating applications. There was an application that was raised in this context in 1973 in Israel during the Yom Kippur War. Was an unfortunate situation in Sinai where some Israeli boys were being fired upon by some other Israeli boys. Unknown, if I break down the communications, they thought they were the enemy and lives were being lost. And in a third group of Israelis, there was a third group of Israelis who couldn't communicate with them but saw what was happening, and there were some religious boys in that group, and they wanted to shoot at the boys in the second group to save the boys in the first. Because the halacha is that you may save a life by taking the life of an assailant. In fact, you may have to. I won't tell you what happened, okay? Come next time and I'll tell you. Those are some of the issues that are involved in this problem of actually taking a life to save a life. Another case that was raised was that Moshe Feinstein was asked in this context, he was required to make this decision of a man coming down by parachute whose friend's parachute doesn't open and the friend catches onto the leg of this man. Now the parachute is beginning to rip because it cannot hold the weight of both of them. Is he allowed to kick his friend off to save his life, or must they both die? These cases are dealt with in the Gemara, not in terms of parachutes, but in terms of other life-saving modalities. Okay, so in the Yitzhak, we'll work through that case, okay, of the twins and all the halachic parameters, but let me mention a few other basics that are involved here. I want to cover some issues for the doctors also, there are one or two important principles here.
Rabbi, what is the position
of dead people? Will you remind me in a second? I want to just mention one or two life issues before that. If I don't get to it in a few minutes, ask me, okay? First of all, before I get there, I just want to be sure to mention, what happens when the dangerous thing that you're doing is not to somebody else, but to the patient himself? I don't want to be guilty of not covering things that the doctors here need. This is a critical issue. Again, what happens when you want to put the patient themselves at risk in order to save their own life? You follow that problem? So there we have a principle like this. Stay tuned now, because it's not that simple. But once you cut it, you'll see it's a very, very useful principle. The principle's like this. If you don't know whether what you're about to do will save a person or, God forbid, kill them, okay, you're completely in doubt whether your intervention here is going to be helpful or harmful, what do you do? For example, don't forget that the Jewish attitude is whatever you can do to help, you have to do. Even a one in a million chance of saving a life, even vaguely, you break Shabbos, you do anything to save that life virtually, except sexual immorality, killing somebody else, and even that may have exceptions like self-defense and so forth, and idolatry. But apart from that, you do anything to save a life. Now, what happens when you have somebody who's like, I'll give you an example. Let's make it practical. Let's say you come across an accident and you see somebody injured. Now, you walk up to the person and you see that their neck looks a bit strange. And you don't know, you don't have to be a doctor for this, by the way. These decisions apply to you at your level of medical knowledge. It doesn't matter how skilled you are, you have to do your best. Now, you look at this person and you see they're sort of gasping a bit. They look like they might not hang on more than a few seconds. And their neck looks like it's a little bit out of line, but you don't know whether it's broken or not. I'm just giving you a scenario. There are millions of scenarios that you could think of yourself. Now, your choice is this. You don't know whether they're about to die because their neck's broken, and straightening their neck and pulling on it gently will save their life, or they're just hanging on because their neck's just about fine, and if you touch them, you'll kill them. You follow that agonizing decision? So you kneel down next to this individual, and you don't know whether you're going to watch an individual die in the next 5 seconds or 30 seconds if you do nothing. And you could save him easily by just doing a simple thing. Or maybe this person's just hanging on and he's going to be fine. But if you touch him, you kill him instantly. What would you say? No? All wrong. Not even one right answer. Heaven for sure. But don't touch him. Don't touch him. Let's understand carefully. What? You see, you all need a bit of time in your shiver. I'll tell you why. The secular world has this principle in medicine also. They have a whole Latin phrase for it, but in the secular medical world, the value that they hold is don't damage. In other words, before you do anything therapeutic, make sure you don't do any harm. Yes, that's the doctor's first obligation in secular terms. Before you do anything to a patient that you hope will help him, make sure you're not going to harm him. And therefore, since you don't know whether you're going to help or harm him, do nothing. But the halakhic reasoning is like this. I don't know if I'm going to convince you about this. It's a simple statistical arithmetical issue. And if you don't believe me, you're wrong. Okay? But I'll do my best so you can think about it and draw it out on a piece of paper. It's like this. What are the statistics facing you? Doing nothing, what are your chances? 50-50, he'll live or die. Correct? Doing something, trying to save him, 50-50, live or die. You agree? So actually it makes no difference. Can you feel that? It actually makes no difference. Whether you act or not act, you're not altering this person's chances of living. Are we agreed? Does anyone not follow that? Okay. However, there's one massive difference. If you do nothing and he dies, he dies. But if you do something and he dies, you kill him. I'll get there. Are you with me? Now we have some Lamdanim here who are suggesting as follows. By being passive, you're also doing something. So the halacha is, a person should die through your non-action rather than your positive action. That's the halacha. He should die if he's going to die because of you. Because you omitted something rather than you committed something. Because you're killing him actively otherwise. If you ran him over. So we should be thankful you stopped. Anyway, anyone not follow that? So you have like this. But of course, you have to understand this is a hypothetical situation where it's exactly 50-50. If it's 50.0001 that you could help him by doing something, do everything you could possibly do. Because you follow me. But that's because you have a chance of doing something. But if the chance of doing something is just as likely to be lethal, are you with me? And therefore, if a patient has an illness where you wish to intervene, but you're not sure whether your intervention will kill or will save the person, rather leave it to Hashem's judgment, then you should be active. However, stay tuned. If the patient is sick already, that means if the patient is terminally ill, that means if they're going to die without your intervention, you may then do things that are very risky. Let me make that clear. If you have a patient who's, God forbid, got a terminal illness, okay, which means in halakhic terms they're not going to survive more than, generally speaking, it means less than a year halakhically, but say a short time. Now you have a medical procedure that you might be able to do that might save the patient for a normal lifespan, which means more than a year, whatever it is, normal chance. But the problem is the procedure that you wish to do is very risky. How risky? The patient might not survive the procedure. Do you follow me? You have a patient who's got a severe heart problem. This problem statistically will kill this patient within weeks, let's say. You could do an operation on this patient that could absolutely make them normal. The problem is a goodly percentage of patients that this operation died during the operation. And that's dying actively. You did it, as opposed to letting it take its natural course. What do you do there, Dr. Muscle? Dr. Marcus? Huh? I always wanted to be one. I only wanted to be those tutorials with a... Anyway, there the answer is, especially the surgical tutorials, for those of you at medical school, you know the way surgeons make you feel when they're examining you. Anyway, the point is, there in that situation, you may certainly take risky action. Because there the Gemara says that the balance of what's called Chaya Olam, which means natural, normal life, as opposed to what's called Chaya Shoah, which means a temporary life because the person is already lethally afflicted, is the justification for enabling you to do something that is even very risky, even considerably risky, you may do, you follow me, even though it may foreshorten, but because it may prolong, you're allowed to do it. Do not think you can apply these principles on your own. You need to ask a question in specific situation. It also depends how risky is the procedure, and it also depends on whether the procedure is experimental or proven. Okay, if it's experimental and you don't know what exactly is happening, then you think, I'll give you a fascinating insight into that, but before I do that, are there any questions, especially from the doctors? Are you clear about when you may take no action and when you are obliged to take action because of the givens of the situation? Those are some of the most important principles that have to be remembered, and they often happen faster than you can think. Okay, if you're working in intensive care situation or in an acute trauma situation, often these things have to have the principles in your hand before you engage in such a situation, because you often don't have time to figure it out or phone your local Orthodox rabbi when these things, and you shouldn't have to, by the way, you should have to phone. The primary time you should have to call for halakhic assistance, generally speaking, is where judgment is required, because at least you'll be getting an objective outside opinion apart from your agonized opinion. But the general halakhic principles you should have at your command in these situations. I mean, don't hesitate to ask also, but often certainly, especially when it comes to prolonging life, where they say we may not, or switch off. certainly when it comes to euthanasia, where they say that the merciful thing is to be active and put somebody out of their suffering, like is the spreading opinion in many places, which is a whole issue in its own right, there's no question about that. Also, there's a dilemma about what constitutes the minimum that should be done to just not be doing a lethal action, even when you're not going to be heroic. We hold that at least food and water, electrolyte balance, and so forth must be maintained, at least those, and perhaps antibiotics, that's a debatable thing, whereas they hold maybe just do nothing, like babies with meningomyelitis and things like that. Certainly, there's unfortunately plenty of conflict. Plenty of conflict. I'll switch off the tape just now and tell you some unofficial things also, yeah? You mean you know that you don't know what you're doing? I understand the question. Yeah. Many of us have gone through that phase. The answer is clear. It's like this. This whole question, all the things we discussed tonight are completely regardless of your level of qualification, okay? Completely regardless. They all go in proportion to the knowledge of the best qualified person on the spot. That person has to do his best, and you're subservient to that person's opinion. You follow?